Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Who is Mothra? What is Mothra? Why does all the world fear Mothra? They found him on an island in the remote Pacific, a monster cave creature discovered by a group of the world's leading scientists, worshipped as a god by the tiniest, loveliest women in all creation, sacred beauties of a lost tribe. See how he stands unscathed by tanks, artillery, dive bombers, rockets, all powerless against his devastating death ray. See how he eludes capture in his impenetrable cocoon, which no human force can open. See him unleash, with a single tremendous breath, the Earth's most fearsome hurricanes, wrecking trains and ships, uprooting bridges and buildings, wreaking havoc on land and sea, thrilling you, chilling you, holding you spellbound. What is the secret of Mothra? Insatiable, indestructible, indescribable. The screen's most fantastic dramatic spectacle, Mothra.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm Rob St. Mary, and with me, of course, co-host Mike White.
Howdy, hey.
And in this week's episode, we take a look at the cult classic, Mothra. So next to Godzilla and Gamera, Mothra, probably the best known of the Japanese giant monsters. This 1961 film is the first in the series and features a team of scientists and military men, as well as one reporter going off to rescue a boat crew that got washed up on an island where some atomic testing was taking place, I guess. And while on the island, the team finds some strange writings that speak of Mothra. What the hell is it? But then they meet these two tiny ladies, and then they decide to bring them back to Japan, and then all kind of craziness takes place. So, Mike, what do you think of the original Mothra?
I'm a huge Mothra fan. If Mothra's on in any incarnation, I will leave it on. I've always been a big fan. I especially love the two little ladies who sing and bring Mothra to them. Just their little song, The Peanuts, it's pretty awesome.
Mothra, yeah. Mothra, Tonganka Sakuya, Indomu, Lusto Willado, Hamba Hamba Muyang, Landa Banguradan, Tonju Kanda.
Yeah, I think the film is really well done. I mean, obviously, we're watching the English dubbed version. I don't know if there is a English subtitled version out there.
There is, and I actually just got done watching that. I watched the Toho Collection, which is a three DVD collection, and it gave the option of a Japanese, you know, language English subtitled version. And it was really kind of neat because they speak English a lot in that movie because they're kind of pointing to this other country, which is very similar to the United States. So it's interesting that all those people are speaking English or this kind of English Japanese hybrid language. So it was kind of a nice experience to actually finally be able to see this film in its original Japanese and see some of the political points that they were making just by what language people were speaking.
A few years before, obviously, 1961, when Mothra comes out, we had the original Godzilla. And in the original Godzilla, there was two different versions. There was the Japanese version, and then there was the American version where they cut it all up and they put Raymond Burr in there. Was there any difference between the original 61 versions of Mothra, or was it pretty much the same, what you got in the States and what you got in Japan?
It was very similar. I would love to do a side-by-side just to see if there is anything else. There were parts where I'm like, oh, I don't remember this, but that generally happens to me when I watch any of these kaiju films. It's just like I kind of blend them all together in my head, because it seems like for a while when I was a kid anyway, they were always playing. So I kind of mash them all up in my head. And then when I watch them individually, it's like, I don't remember this part at all. But of course, it's been there forever. I didn't see a huge amount of difference other than just being able to tell who was speaking English and who was originally speaking Japanese.
Yeah, as for the film, I mean, we did talk a little bit about it. I mean, I think we pretty much encapsulated the plot. It's a pretty simple plot. As for what you liked about the film.
Well, I like that it's kind of a retelling of the whole King Kong story. These guys going to this allegedly deserted island and coming across this native tribe who worship this creature, and we don't necessarily know everything about it. And then you kind of have this evil promoter who is a guy from Rolissica, which is basically the United States, but just given a different name. And he's really slimy, and he kidnaps the two little women and takes them back to Japan and, you know, has them sing and puts on these big stage shows and stuff. And there's no moment of, you know, Mothra going crazy and like breaking through the back wall and killing everyone in downtown Tokyo. That's kind of comes later on, but it's nice that it's kind of this retelling of, you know, I guess it's kind of a universal story, this whole let's exploit the peasant people and take what's great for them and transport it into our culture and then exploit it and make all kinds of money out of it.
Yeah, I think that really is the big difference between, if we talk about the difference between Godzilla and Mothra. I mean, obviously Godzilla was more a statement on nuclear war and man's mistreatment of the earth in some manner, but Mothra seems to be more about don't mess with the native people, and when you do, bad things happen, such as the theft of these two little ladies and trying to turn them into the latest cultural exhibition.
Yeah, you get a little bit of that as far as the island that they're on. I think it's kind of it's a forbidden island because they were doing nuclear testing on it and no one was supposed to be there. So there's a part in Mothra right towards the beginning where they rescue these guys who had washed up on the island, and they're asking them, you know, how do you feel? Is there signs of radiation and all this kind of stuff? So kind of minor to that. And then once the plot gets going, they kind of drop all that together. But then at the same time, it's like, well, is Mothra kind of a product of this nuclear testing? You know, did they always worship this giant egg, or was there, you know, was that a smaller egg at one point before the testing had happened?
The one thing I really like about it, and this might just be me being a journalist by trade, is that the journalist gets all this access. They just love this guy. They drag him around. They're talking to him all the time. It's like, I wish that I was given that kind of access to go all over the place and do all this kind of crazy stuff when there's this big, huge crisis involved.
Yeah. I just wish he had been given a better photographer, because I love at the end after Mothra comes down and, you know, all this stuff happens and then, you know, takes off again, and the photographer's like, oh, yeah, I should have been taking pictures. And it's like, oh, come on, lady.
Always be shooting. Always yes. Be shooting.
Yeah, you would think. You would think that she might have, you know, had that camera kind of glued to her eye, but whatever. But yeah, I like that character, and I like that he is definitely very dogged in his journalistic enthusiasm. He wants to be where the story's at, and he's going to do whatever it takes to get there.
You know, and looking at him, and I didn't realize this when we first took a look at this over the summer, but looking at him now, you know what he kind of looks like?
Gangnam Style. 낮에는 따사로운 인간적인 여자 커피
인간적인 여자 Totally.
I just like, wow, I put that together. Maybe it's like his grandfather or something. I don't know.
Very nice.
But obviously, when you're going to watch one of the big monster films, the big Japanese monster films, it all is about the special effects and all about the monster. I mean, considering it's 1961, okay, this is 51 years ago. What do you think about the effects in the film?
I thought they were actually really good. It was, you know, I love practical effects. And seeing some of the stuff that they were doing, there were even parts where I was like, okay, I don't know if that's really a remote-controlled vehicle or if that is a real vehicle. Like, towards the end when they're kind of doing this painting on the ground and it's all of these vehicles that are doing this, you know, painting, and it's like, is that real or is that not? And it's nice that I actually have a few moments of doubt there. And some of the composite shots, I think, are pretty well done. It's not that cheesy, you know, oh, look, there's the monster, you know, in the two shot or the one shot and then cut to the really fakey thing, you know, going across the screen. I mean, of course, you know, when Mothra's wings are flapping and stuff is being blown all over the place, you know, yeah, it's models and everything. But some of the other shots, I think, are fairly well done. And some of the shots, especially with the two ladies, because, you know, they're only like, what, 10 inches high or something. Some of those are, yeah, okay, we're going to pick up these little Barbie type dolls and move people, you know, these girls from one place to another. But some of the shots where you get to see them interact with the regular people look pretty good.
Another thing about Mothra is that when you put the monster's name in the title of the film, modern audiences expect to see said monster in the first reel. With this, it takes at least 50 minutes before you get to see the larva and then the cocoon, and then it takes like 20 minutes. So it's like 70 minutes into a 90-minute movie before we even get to see Mothra. So it's almost sort of a Jaws kind of thing, but even further out. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's funny. I've been thinking about that lately because I just went to see Curse of the Werewolf. And you really don't get to see the werewolf, Oliver Reed as the werewolf, until 10 minutes before the end. And with that one, I was getting a little frustrated, and it could have just been because the movie was extended a little bit because of some real change issues. But then there are other movies where, like in Aliens, James Cameron's Aliens, where you don't see the creatures until 50 minutes into the movie, maybe even longer if you're watching the director's cut. And it's like, okay, wow. You know, when that moment comes, it is so gratifying. But yeah, you're right. It is interesting, too, that because Mothra has the different stages of life. God, I wish I could remember the line from Silence of the Lambs.
The significance of the moth is change. Caterpillar into chrysalis or pupa. And from thence into beauty.
Since he has the different stages, he's kind of, you know, a couple creatures in one almost, or she, I should say, is kind of a couple creatures in one.
Yeah, not only that, but as we were talking about sort of modern audiences expecting to see Mothra in the first reel, when they did the remake, what was it, in the 90s?
Yeah, the rebirth of Mothra was 1996.
Yeah, so when they do the remake, when Toho decides, you know, we're going to reboot Mothra, what do you get? You get the two ladies riding Mothra like in the first 5 minutes of the film. So it just goes to show that you couldn't really do this kind of movie nowadays. I just don't think that modern audiences are hip to sit around for 70 minutes until the creature shows up.
Yeah, you would at least get a sneak peek, you know, a good shadow on the wall or something like that beforehand. But yeah, it's funny that it's that little mini Mothra they're riding around at first, which is like, what? I thought Mothra was a lot bigger than this.
Mini Mothra. That's like the iPad, isn't it? The iPad Mini?
Exactly. Yes. It's not an iPhone. It's not an iPad. It's an iPad Mini or an iPod Maxi.
We're getting way too into the feminine hygiene products here.
All right, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back with a couple interviews we did with some folks who know a little bit more about Japanese monster movies than we do. We talked recently to Stuart Galbraith IV and Peter H. Brothers.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOTH at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out adamandeve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at adamandeve.com.
Excuse me, what are you doing? Are you looking for porn again?
No.
Well, what is that I see?
It's not porn. It's the badassboobsandbodycounts.com website. I happen to be looking at the reviews in the boobs section of the site.
They have a section of the site dedicated to boobs?
Yes, they do. They cover exploitation films in the boobs category, action films in the badass category, and horror in the body counts category.
What's that other option, BBNBC podcast?
If you're not into reading the reviews, you can listen to them via the web on your mobile device. flies through iTunes, and they cover the same types of films, lesser known action, exploitation, and horror cinema. So yeah, to answer your question, I wasn't cruising porn.
That's too bad.
What's too bad?
That you weren't cruising for porn.
Why?
Because I was feeling kind of horny.
Oh, wait. Get back here. Hey, get back here.
This is Jamie from Devour the Podcast. Do you enjoy horror commentary with straightforward honesty?
This is just a bad movie. This is not at all good in any way, shape, or form.
Because there's one word I have to describe this movie, and it is derivative.
Humor and an obvious passion for the genre.
I was in search of the stop button.
Yeah, I know. In search of a plot. That's what this movie should be called. You're right. So, 0 out of 5. Fuck this movie. Don't watch it.
Then you should spend time with David and me as we discuss horror films from old classics.
Deep Red. The Dunwich Horror. Maniac.
To new favorites.
Love and Horizon. House of the Devil. Slaughter Night.
Come listen to Devour the Podcast. Check us out on iTunes or at devourthepodcast.blogspot.com. Devour the Podcast is a proud member of the Horrorphilia Podcasting Network.
We're primarily focusing on Mothra, but Mothra really is kind of one of the entries in a long line of action stars, as it were. How do you see Mothra kind of fitting into this universe?
Basically, I think Mothra was made at the peak of both the evolution of the genre and also at the peak of the Japanese film industry generally. It was made at a time when Japan was producing more feature films than any other country in the world, including India. And yet, at the same time, the quality of the movies from a technical and aesthetic point of view was very, very high. So this is the same period in which people like Kurosawa and Ozu and Naruse and Imamura and Oshima all were making movies. And there were also, at the same time, these great genre movies coming out by people like Kenji Fukasaku and Seijun Suzuki. So Mothra kind of fits in with this time when the industry was just about at its peak. And the movie itself is more ambitious and in some ways more adult than the monster movies that followed. Certainly by the time you get to the 70s, they were made almost exclusively for kids. This one is much more ambitious than the usual, than the run-of-the-mill Japanese monster movie.
One of the things that you talk about in your first book, Japanese Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Films, is the way that Japanese people would see films versus the way that Americans would look at things. What kind of differences can you kind of elucidate for us just so we, you know, can really kind of set the context for this film?
There's obviously a lot of domestic things going on that American audiences would not have picked up or understood. Right before this movie was released, there was a very controversial security pact signed between the United States and Japan, which sparked all kinds of student protests throughout the country. And it was very controversial, and it basically solidified the Cold War relationship between Japan and the United States. And so there is this undercurrent in Mothra where you have this tension going on between Japan and this fictional country called Relisica, but it's basically supposed to be the United States. So a lot of the drama hinges on this tension that's going on. And the original script was even more explicit about in this. In fact, the character of the female reporter played by Kyoko Kagawa was originally supposed to be a student protester. So that was changed. But there's still a lot of that in the film. It's very understated, I think.
I've read that this was actually based on a short story.
That I don't believe so. I think if I remember correctly, what they ended up doing was usually in the past, Toho had turned to sci-fi writers to come up with the stories. And then usually Toho staff screenwriters would actually write the script. In this case, they hired a group of novelists who wrote regular non-genre fiction. They came up with the original story, and then a screenwriter named Shinichi Sekizawa, who is one of the most prolific writers in this monster movie genre, came in and wrote the final script, which was quite different. He took out a lot of the political content, but on the other hand, made it more broadly appealing, I think, to a general Japanese audience.
Mothra is part of a whole lineup of different monsters. Do you know anything in reference to how they decided to hone in on a moth?
That I cannot answer. Obviously, they were looking for something new. In the United States, there, of course, had been tons of giant insect movies like Tarantula and the Deadly Mantis and The Beginning of the End and the Black Scorpion and things like that. I don't think that there's much of a connection, except maybe they simply looked at all these American movies coming out and decided that a moth hadn't been done yet. So they turned to a moth. I don't know. Possibly another thing that appealed to them was this idea of this creature starting out as a kind of caterpillar in the larva form and then blossoming into this beautiful moth. That's certainly a visually appealing concept, but beyond that, I really don't know.
From a technical standpoint, how were they able to pull off the various stages of Mothra? I mean, we all know that Godzilla is a guy in a suit.
I think to some degree that's a little bit misunderstood, which is that certainly the man in the rubber suit is kind of the central part of the way these special effects are done. But the special effects director, Eiji Tsuburaya, actually used all different kinds of special effects, optical effects and cell animation and matting and matte paintings and multiple compositions. And even on an extremely limited basis, even a very small amount of stop motion animation, although they usually didn't have much time to do any of that. In the case of Mothra, they did all different kinds of things. And the actor who played Godzilla, Haruo Nakajima, is actually in a kind of Mothra costume in some scenes in the movie, where Mothra in larva form is rampaging through Tokyo, heading for Tokyo Tower. That was an elaborate costume that was kind of like a Chinese dragon that you see in parades, where it was this very long costume, about 25 feet long and about 6 feet high. And Nakajima was at the front of the line, leading everybody, and then they just hired a bunch of people to fill out the suit. But most of the rest of the time, it was done through a combination of puppetry and very elaborate marionettes and many different scale models, too. So it wasn't just obviously a guy in a suit this time.
You started off your writing career with the Japanese science fiction, and you kind of followed it up years later with the Japanese filmography, Monsters Are Attacking Tokyo, Toho Studios. Do you ever wish to escape, or how is it kind of going back and revisiting these familiar faces?
Well, you know, it's very interesting, because my first book I did 20 years ago. And at that point, things were really, really different, because for one thing, it was virtually impossible to see the original Japanese versions of these movies. The only way to really see them was to buy bootleg videos, or when I went to Japan to do interviews, I would prowl around the Laserdisc shops in Tokyo and buy as many Laserdiscs as I could afford. And that was it. I mean, there were no other options. And of course, now for example, recently, Criterion released this beautiful Blu-ray set of the original Gojira with both the Japanese and American versions, so people can compare and contrast in ways that were virtually impossible back then. And there was also very little scholarship 20 years ago. Now people have written very extensively about these movies, and most of the surviving directors and writers and special effects guys and actors and so forth have been tracked down and have been interviewed extensively. So there's just a ton of more information now than there was back then.
When we talk about films like Mothra or Gojira or, you know, all of these monster films, right, how are they sort of viewed then and viewed now? I mean, are they respected, or are they sort of looked upon like in America, where there's sort of two modes on it? There's like culty folks who really like them, and then sort of the mainstream audience just sees them as sort of like ridiculous, trashy fun.
Mothra was a very enormous mainstream hit. So it was a monster movie that was seen by everybody. Pretty much all of the early Japanese science fiction spectacles were seen by a mainstream audience. And many of these, Mothra included, were among the top 10 grossing movies in Japan – that year. So Mothra was in the top 10, I forget exactly where, and it outgrossed most imported Hollywood movies even. Part of the reason was the early movies were a little bit more adult in terms of content, and Mothra features the Peanuts, Emi and Yumi Ito, who play the twin fairies. They were huge Japanese pop stars at the time. In fact, they were probably the most popular pop singers of the 1960s. It pulled in that audience, and Mothra in particular was very popular with female audiences in Japan. So it was a big mainstream hit. And then eventually that changed. The monster movies of the mid and later 60s were targeting teenagers more than adults. And then by the 1970s, they were made exclusively for kids. In fact, some of the later Godzilla movies were specifically made for these packages of kind of kiddie matinees that would also – a package that would include cartoons and other things that were just for children, basically.
When they had their revival of Godzilla and Mothra during the 90s, did they kind of get back to their roots, or did they kind of remain more of a kiddie fare?
The 1992 film Godzilla vs. Mothra was again a mainstream hit. It was probably the one 90s Godzilla movie that attracted a large general audience. The one before that, Godzilla vs. King Ghidorah, also did that to some degree. But then after that, the audience went down and down and down, and was primarily attracting, again, children and by now a generation of adult fans. Otaku, if you will, kind of hardcore Godzilla fan. I mean, there hasn't been a new Godzilla movie in quite a few years, but Godzilla right now in Japan is seen as a real niche market, I think, primarily for hardcore fans.
Is there a real difference between the Japanese version and the American version, like other versions of the monster films?
In this case, not so much. In this case, this was released originally by Columbia Pictures in the United States. And compared with a lot of U.S. distributors, Columbia put a lot of time and care into the English dubbed version. Now that the Japanese versions of these movies are widely available, normally I can't watch dubbed versions of Japanese movies anymore. But Mothra is kind of an exception because it's done so well. And some of the cutting, I think, actually even helps a little bit. The Japanese version, I think, is about 10 minutes longer. There's a few scenes that are a little bit sluggish, and I think that the cutting in the American version just it sort of tightens things up a little bit. They didn't make many edits because of content. They took out some of the – there's a few religious images and things like that that they decided to take out, and they trimmed some of the musical sequences a little bit. But basically, they left it alone. It was a very respectful handling of the film, I think.
When it comes to Godzilla, there's such a great metaphor there as far as the dangers of nuclear power and nuclear bombs and everything. Was that kind of wearing off as we got more into Mothra, or were there other things that you can see where there was some subtext going on there?
There's a slight reference to nuclear testing and so on, but I think it's much more it's generally a lot more lighthearted movie, but I think there's also this subtext of cultural imperialism in terms of this Rilisican character played by Jerry Ito, who DVD savant quite accurately described him as a cross between Carl Denham and Al Capone. So he's basically this blustery American who comes in, and first his country pretty much destroys this island through nuclear testing, and then goes in and kidnaps these, you know, tiny priestesses and makes them part of his kind of Andrew Lloyd Webber type musical extravaganza and exploits them. And so I think there is that going on. But again, it's because of the revisions that were made to the script, it's basically just a kind of colorful spectacle more than anything else.
How do these movies, the older films, you know, the ones from the 50s and the 60s before they got off into kiddie fare, how do they still hold up in Japanese pop culture and people who take them seriously? Or are they still considered sort of a niche thing that only, you know, certain freaky folks in Japan care about?
As as of now, they're largely limited to diehard fans. The films are shown on Japanese cable television and that sort of thing. Part of it is the Japanese film industry constantly shoots itself in the foot, in its own foot, with the way it handles its own film history. For example, here in Japan, you can buy DVDs and Blu-rays of American movies for about one-fifth the cost of a Japanese movie. So if you can get like five American movies for one ozu, for instance, and Japanese monster movies are incredibly expensive on DVD and Blu-ray in Japan, upwards of about $60 American, compared to DVDs of Blu-rays and DVDs here, which you can get for of American movies, which are like, you know, $10. I think that's really limited the audience, unfortunately. I think the Japanese really don't care about their film history and their cultural heritage in quite the way American studios do. So,
as you're doing your research and everything, do you ever get kind of this, why are you asking me about this film that's just kind of garbage kind of stuff?
The Japanese filmmakers, no, not at all. I think the Japanese filmmakers, for the most part, are usually surprised that I'm even aware of their movies. A lot, when I first started doing interviews in the mid-1990s, very often the filmmakers were not aware that their films had been distributed in America, or if they had been aware, they weren't aware that people were still interested in them now. So for the most part, they were flattered to be asked about them. And there's just not the stigma of working on or acting in a monster movie in Japan the way that there might be in America. Something like Mothra was a big scale, A picture production, and nothing at all to be ashamed about.
You're doing more than just kind of a look at film to film to film, though you do have that kind of, you know, capsule review and discussion. But I like that you put that into a larger body of work with just Honda at the lead of these things, which I thought was great, so that you can pick up these different themes that he has and that he retreads, or just ideas, or, you know, just commonalities between his films.
Well, thank you. As a matter of fact, as far as I know, that's the first time that anybody's ever written about Honda as a thematic filmmaker. I mean, there are themes, there are messages that Honda puts into a lot of his pictures. It seems that they all have a certain subtext to them that goes beyond the visual. I really think that he was trying to teach his audiences a lesson without being preachy about it. I mean, we all know, of course, that Godzilla is really about the atomic and hydrogen bomb and what Japan went through with the last few months of World War II with the fire raids and all that. And Matango is really a study of individual morality amidst social chaos. Rodan and Half Human are all themes having to do with the environment. So that was, I think that's one of the things that puts him beyond, you know, a regular monster movie director. He also had a wonderful team over at Toho, and the studio was pretty much at its height in those days. And they were all very, very serious filmmakers. You know, one of the things that drove me crazy about this book and why I had to eventually self-publish it was because I would contact publishers and they would say to me in so many words, "Well, you're kidding, right? I mean, this is the guy who makes those goofy movies." You know, and they go, "Wait a minute. You know, every genre deserves respect. I mean, whether you're talking about kung fu fantasy films or Mexican wrestling horror pictures or whatever it is, it's appealing to a certain audience that enjoys those films." And I was fascinated that still to this day, Honda is considered by many serious film scholars as a cult director, a director of cult films as opposed to mass audience, which was really what he was all about. So it was very important for me to let people know, hey, you know what? That's why I mentioned, you know, people like Alfred Hitchcock and Orson Welles and John Ford. If people can read that and not raise their eyebrows and say, "You're putting Honda in the context with all these filmmakers," well, yeah, if that doesn't jump out at you, then we can kind of go from there. The main thing is to be objective. And of course, most people are familiar only with the westernized versions of his films, which of course have the terrible dubbing and stock music, and sometimes have been re-edited, and of course, with American scenes put in. Mothra isn't too bad. There were some little clips, but again, the dubbing is just, it's just not all that great. I mean, there's one scene where Mothra's on the rampage, and the monster is now attacking Tokyo Tower. If the tower is destroyed, we will continue broadcasting from alternate facilities. I mean, this is what happens when you have a Caucasian trying to do an Asian, you know. They're doing a little bit better with it now, but yeah, I just wanted people to take him seriously and the film seriously, and they see the transition when he started out as a very serious filmmaker. I mean, from the mid-1950s to the early 60s, these are very serious films, with the exception of, say, King Kong versus Godzilla, which was intended as a comedy. Then they started to get silly by the mid-1960s. A lot of people, those are the films that they remember. But I always have to be careful, Mike, not to knock any of these pictures, because I gave a talk recently at the WonderCon out in Anaheim, and I made some, not a disparaging remark about Godzilla versus Megalon, but I guess I kind of raised my eyebrows, and my wife was in the crowd, heard somebody mutter, "I like Megalon," so I have to be careful. I'm not knocking them, because I know what it's like to be in that boat, because I used to go to a lot of horror and science fiction conventions in the mid-1970s, and that's all people would do, would just knock these films. I remember one night I went to, they were showing three of Honda's films, all in their American versions. Mysterians was first, then Mothra, and then Ghidra. So it was kind of a long evening. And the audience was just totally disrespectful. And I, you know, 200 people, and I'm the one person saying, you know, will you be quiet and just watch the film? One guy turned and looked at me like I had the problem. So for me, this is really kind of to try to set the accounts in proper balance and kind of swing the pendulum back the other way.
Yeah, I like that you had pointed out that so many of Honda's films have this kind of quasi-documentary feel to them. Where do you think that came from? Had he been a documentarian before?
I'm not exactly sure where Honda, you know, he studied under Kenji Yamamoto, who was the same director who tutored Akira Kurosawa. And I really can't say that Kurosawa's films have quite that impact. It may have something to do with the fact that Honda tends to be very objective in his directing. It's usually difficult for an audience to identify with any single character in his films. There seems to be sort of a distancing that's involved, almost like third person. There's an impartiality to a lot of his work, and that may account for some of it. Also, the fact that while there's tremendous music in a lot of his films, it's used very sparingly. He does a lot of location shooting, as you see in a lot of documentaries. And his topics just seem to be the kinds of things that a lot of people relate to, especially man's conflict with nature, which was a big thing for Honda.
We talked a little bit about the metaphors for some of these films. What do you see as kind of the underlying theme as far as Mothra goes?
I think Mothra has to do with diplomatic immunity to a certain extent. It gets into a theme that's very similar to Gorgo. One of the things that's fascinated me, the English film Gorgo and Mothra have many striking similarities. They both involve expeditions to islands where they find something that is very unique, and they capture it and bring it back to the capital city. And then the sort of parent figure comes after them, causes all kinds of damage, and rescues them. I think it had something to do with that, and also bureaucracy. There's all this red tape. Also, how far journalism can go in being honest and being objective, the way they report things. And I think it's fascinating, the idea that the Shobijin, probably more commonly known as the Twin Fairies, are treated as part of like a Broadway show. If this is to happen in real life, that's probably what would happen.
Well, it really kind of recalls for me the exploitation of like King Kong.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And just that kind of Carl Denham character and stealing these girls from their island where they're worshipped. I mean, it almost feels like King Kong, if he had been split in two, you know, the fairies being one thing and then Mothra coming in and kind of kicking butt, but not necessarily doing it maliciously.
That's right. And in Mothra, they have plenty of warning. You know, the Shobijin say, you know, you really should return us, because if you don't, there's going to be a lot of destruction, a lot of people are going to be killed and everything. And after the success of Godzilla, it began this whole incredible genre. And Shinichi Sekizawa, who wrote the screenplay for Mothra was much more interested in the sort of family fantasy element that these films had. And Honda had just turned 50. He had been directing feature-length films for 10 years. He was really at the peak of his powers. One of my favorite scenes in Mothra is when Nelson is driving through the little courtyard, and he's surrounded by all of these people who recognize him. And then as he's trying to figure out what to do and he's looking at the crowd, suddenly the images of all these natives that he's shot in capturing the girls come flashing into his face, and the music becomes very heroic, and it's he dies in a very kind of stylized manner, and it's just tremendous. If aliens came down from outer space and they knocked on my door and they said, we hear about all these genres, we're going to all these people, we hear about this Japanese monster fantasy genre, what would be the film for us to take back to Zolan or whatever, that would be the most representative? And I would say Mothra, because it's all there. You know, it's still a film that's made for adults that children can enjoy very, very much. It's just a fascinating movie and very moving in spots. And if you're like me, when those gals get up there and start singing that song, it really gets to me. Of course, it throws me back to when I first saw the film back in, I think it was 62 when it finally played in America. And, it's a very, very, it's the colors. And there's also that kind of religious thing that's going on. Honda was non-denominational. He was brought up in a Buddhist household, but he didn't subscribe to any particular religion. But Eiji Tsuburaya, his brilliant special effects director, was Catholic. And you can see these sort of Catholic symbols. I mean, the Mothra symbol itself is sort of a thinly disguised cross. And when the moth, the adult version of Mothra, is creating all this destruction, these priests are asking for guidance, and then it's noticed that the cross backlit by the sun looks like the Mothra symbol, and so they ring church bells to kind of calm it down. So it's okay. It's not preachy. It reminds me a little bit of George Powell's War of the Worlds, where the church thing is kind of the churches don't really get hit. They get banged up a little, but I mean, they're all surviving, and that final shot shows a church, and all right, well, that's fine, I guess. But you have that going on in Mothra too, which is quite interesting.
If you want to get really into it, you could say that he's kind of resurrected after he goes into his cocoon.
Yes, that's very true. So there could be that particular subtext as well. This whole thing about not necessarily Catholicism, but I mean just something about, something that is inherently good, that it's through no fault of its own, and it's being persecuted. In a lot of the monster films that the Japanese did, you see the military opening up with everything, and they don't often hit the monster. And this was primarily because of technical reasons, because you'd have to wire the suit with squibs and all this kind of stuff. Well, Mothra, the larva is just getting pummeled. I mean, they never miss. I mean, they're just hitting the heck out of this thing, and then finally grabs the tower in that great scene, and it crashes on over. And it's like when I was a kid, I was very distraught over this. And I'm thinking, this is really something to do to feel sorry about a bug, a caterpillar that can swim. But we won't get into that because, that's all part of the fantasy thing. But that's a great scene, too, where they drop the gas cans and they try to set it on fire. And, they redid a lot of that in 1992 with the Mothra versus Godzilla movie that Kawakita did the special effects. And they're very good, but I'm not sure if he captured the grandeur of what Tsuburaya. When I was seeing the Mothra larva rampage, I knew it was not real. In fact, it's kind of interesting in that almost every vehicle in that sequence is a miniature. Some of the jets are real, but Tsuburaya would usually intercut between a miniature and a real thing. But he creates a totally artificial environment that we can immerse ourselves in where anything can happen. And I mean, even when the Mothra larvae is starting to spin its cocoon and this unfortunate helicopter gets caught and it crashes, the way it crashes is also just sort of, I mean, it's almost ballet-like. It just sort of falls almost gently to the ground. It doesn't go spinning and careening off and there's, terrible explosion. It's just, very poetic. That, to me, describes a lot of Tsuburaya's effects. And, of course, he had the heart of a child, as he often said. And that comes across, too, in this film.
Yeah, I was always impressed by the way that Mothra flew. I mean, it just always struck me. It was very majestic.
Very majestic. They improved upon it a little bit in the next film, Godzilla vs. the Thing, where it got the head twitching and the legs kind of moving, and that was very good. You know, it's an amazing thing. People say, oh, you know, it's a guy in a suit. And I go, wait a minute. Now, just hold the phone. Harryhausen has used guys in suits. Harryhausen has used puppets. Lucas and Spielberg have done the same thing. But I don't hear these guys squawking when they do it. You know, the first time you and I saw Yoda, we knew it was a puppet, and we dug it. It was, okay, we understand what's going on here. This is a two-way street. You're presenting this puppet, and you're saying, we want you to believe that it's real. And so there's a certain kind of give and take that's going on. If you're just going to sit back and look at the technical aspect, well, you know, that's fine, but that's sort of hollow. I thought that the puppet work that was done in that film was fine, and you just have to accept it on its own terms, like any fantasy film, really. And it was a very successful film for Honda, did great business worldwide, and it sort of started the second golden age, which was, it didn't have a lot of the serious adult trappings of the first one, but it really got things going internationally, I think, for the Japanese monster movies. And there hasn't been, I think there's been about two or three Mothra movies recently. But anyway, you know, they were pretty much all adult pictures up until Mothra, which is like an adult and kid flick. The next couple of films were still pretty serious. But then, you know, when King Kong versus Godzilla, which was a comedy, did tremendous business. And then Godzilla versus the Thing came out in a superb film and totally serious, but it didn't do anywhere near the business that Kong and Godzilla did, and that was the beginning of the end as far as the serious part of the genre was concerned, because then it just got, you know, sillier and sillier. The films certainly have their points and their merits, and even Honda directed a few of them, but by that time he was pretty fed up because he had started out directing all kinds of pictures, war films, social dramas, adolescent love stories, salaryman comedies. But when the fantasy films kept bringing in the big box office, eventually, by the time of the mid-60s, that was all that they were letting him do. And he was getting fed up with the whole thing. He says, please, I don't want to direct any more Godzilla films. You know, after Monster Zero, he said, that's it. I don't want to be known as the Godzilla guy. And so Tanaka said, okay, well, we'll take you off the Godzilla series. We have another film lined up for you. Oh, great. What is it? King Kong Escapes, you know, or something like that. And it's like, well, all right. Or War of the Gargantuas or something like that. So for Honda, it was definitely a mixed blessing. With Honda's centennial, it's nice for him to be remembered. And of course, Godzilla is always the film they mention. If Honda were here, we'd say, well, that's fine. I mean, yeah, it's a terrific film, but don't forget, you know, I directed over 40 other feature-length films, you know, and I did other things as well. I assistant directed Kurosawa in a number of his films. And
so when it came to writing the book, what was it that finally kind of pushed you over the edge?
You know, the best way for me to answer that is when George Lucas was asked why he made Star Wars, he said, because nobody else was. I mean, I had been thinking about writing this book for 30 years. I kept waiting for somebody to do it. And there were some books that came out on the genre, but nothing just about Honda. And so I thought, well, you know, I guess I better start getting up there and doing it. And I remember talking to some people, and they were saying, oh, you know, I don't think that's a good idea. I don't think people would be interested in this. And I said, well, you know what? It's my money. I mean, he's my guy, and not only my guy, but there's thousands, if not millions, of fans of his out there. As Cine Fantastique said when they reviewed my book, they said it was long overdue. And the book really should have come out 5-10 years earlier. There are a couple of books in Japan that came out on Honda, but nothing in this country. And now, from what I understand, there may be another one coming out on Honda in the next few months. So we'll wait and see. You know, I didn't get into the television work. I didn't get into his non-monster films because, for one thing, I don't have access to them. It was only because I was able to get a print of his Abominable Snowman, the one film of his, the one fantasy film of his 25 that has never been released on video because of political reasons, you know. And also, it was like a my way of saying thank you. Honda was, for me and like for so many other people, one of so many creative individuals that made our childhood so wonderful. And the fact that we're still talking about these films as adults, Mike, says something about Honda's work.
And we're back. It was great talking to Stuart Galbraith IV and Peter H. Brothers all about the fun of Japanese monster movies. And, of course, you can find out more about them and their books and everything that they're up to at our website, projection-booth.com. Now, Mike, just following up on Mothra, you know, we talked quite a bit on the front end about it. But are there any final points that you want to make on this quality little piece of cinema from 1961?
Well, it was interesting to me, the whole Christian theme that we have kind of going on through here. I mean, we talked a little bit with the guys about that, but it was just kind of fascinating to me how the whole Christianity kind of played into this movie and the crosses. And I mean, even from the opening title card, you know, at least on the one that I just saw, the Japanese version, there's, you know, the three characters from Mothra, and then you get the cross in the upper right hand corner, and it's like, oh, okay. So it was kind of nice to see how, you know, the whole Christian theme is kind of playing through the movie. I mean, it's, you know, to me, of course, it's a little like, oh, geez, you know, why did we have to ruin yet another culture with Christianity? But at the same time, I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting.
So Mothra's out there spreading the chick tracks.
Exactly. You know, another thing that's kind of interesting too, we talked a few months ago to David Coleman about Sasquatch films, and the guy who directed this, Ishiro Honda, he had done The Abominable Snowman, which was one of David's like top three Sasquatch movies. And really, there's a lot of similarities here too, where it's kind of this, you know, the way that the native people, again, were kind of being repressed and exploited. And so I don't know if Honda was necessarily, you know, working out issues himself, or that was just kind of this pervasive theme that, you know, a lot of Japanese movies had, where it's like, you know, the smaller, you know, islands or different, you know, subsets or whatever of ethnicities that were kind of being exploited by, you know, the larger group. So it was kind of nice to see a comparison between those two films as well.
Very nice. Well, as for Mothra, how can people get it? What kind of versions are there of the 1961 original, and also maybe one of the modern day ones, as we talked about back in the 90s, that reboot?
Yeah, I think most of those are available fairly readily now through, like, you know, just different DVD retailers. So we can go ahead, we'll post some links up for folks. You know, there are different box sets now. But yeah, this, the one that I was talking about earlier with the version of Mothra that has the Japanese and the English, it also has DVD commentary tracks. And, you know, it's really kind of a nice, it's, I wouldn't say it's deluxe, but it's, you know, it's got a lot of good stuff on it. So definitely something worthwhile. And then I'm not sure if I really am too hip on the remakes of Mothra. You know, I love the remakes of like the Gamera films, because they seem to be much more adult, even though, you know, Gamera's kind of the hero of children. And Mothra is one of the only other like real defenders of the earth kind of thing. But they just, they were really kind of kiddie movies to me, the whole rebirth of Mothra series. So not a huge fan. I would definitely recommend that people check out Godzilla versus Mothra, though. That was a pretty good one. And then Godzilla, or sorry, what was the, it was the King Ghidorah movie that he was in too, where he has to basically, Mothra talks all of the other monsters that are in there into teaming up versus Ghidorah. Oh, it was Ghidorah, the three-headed monster. So it was pretty good. It took three monsters to, three or four, I think, to take out Ghidorah. So that was good. And Mothra was a good mediator for all of the other monsters.
See, that's what happens when you get the ladies. They get a little excited, because Mothra, remember, is a lady, and she don't play.
No, not at all.
All right, we're going to take a break and play a preview for next week's show.
What happened to Dr. Waterman? Only this man, last to see him alive, knows. Invisible barrier between good and evil. The invisible barrier between light and the forces of darkness. A weird,
the unbelievable, the supernatural before your very eyes. As four teenage boys and girls fight a devil cult for their sanity, for their lives, for their eternal souls. Equinox, a story that defies logic, confounds belief.
I can't believe it. It was just a fall.
What is the secret of the thousand-year-old book? What are the unspeakable horrors conjured by the forces of evil? What is the fiendish power of the ring that enslaves and destroys? What is the one symbol that can hold at bay the hosts of hell unleashed on earth?
My cross! My cross! They're coming to kill me!
That was the trailer for Equinox. Make sure to stop by as we talk to writer Mark Thomas McGee, who will join us. And also a special appearance by a good friend of mine, Detroit rapper and rare book dealer Doc Waffles. That's his stage name. His real name is Ben Ness. Very nice guy. And share some secrets of his trade for reasons that will become rather apparent if you've seen Equinox or listened to the episode. So all that and more fun coming up.
So, yeah, thanks for listening. Be sure to stop by our website, projection-booth.com, or our Facebook page and leave us some feedback. We also love seeing your reviews and ratings on iTunes. That helps us here at the Projection Booth to become the best reviewed podcast around. So please leave a rating, send us your feedback. And hey, don't forget, folks, we're still collecting phone calls for our Reservoir Dogs episode, which is coming up in February 2013. So give us a call, leave us a voicemail, send us an MP3, send us some smoke signals. We might not see those. Our number here is 734-666-0800. Go ahead, pick up the phone. It's free when you call from work, and you can leave us a little message there. Tell us what you think about Reservoir Dogs, Quentin Tarantino, whatever else you think, or, you know, sing us a little song about how you can call Mothra from his island to you.
Yay, Mothra!
Darkness or hell, out she came.